All right, next matter is Roger Bryan Clark II against the Commonwealth. Have Mr. McNamara and Mr. Shapiro. Mr. McNamara, how are you doing today?
Doing well, Your Honor. How are you?
It's fine, thank you. Here, is there any of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
I'm glad to hear from you when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Daniel McNamara. I represent Mr. Clark. It is our position that the Circuit Court did not delegate the authority to the Office of Probation and Parole to...
Your bottom line is, unless the trial court impose these various probation restrictions, that the probation officer can't impose anything?
It's not our position that the trial, that the probation office can't impose anything.
Just not this.
Not this, and not a lot of things. The order of the circuit court, when it imposed the conditions on Mr. Clark of the probation, it said that the probation office would supervise him. It said that it could reduce his level of supervision as it saw fit. It said that it would ensure that Mr. Clark abided by the terms of the Sex Offender and Crimes Against Minors Registry, and it said that the probation office could supervise Mr. Clark.
The question is a little bit broader. If I understand your position, that unless the trial court specifically imposed these special conditions, that the probation officer couldn't do it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, can you follow up on Judge Frank's question? That's not exactly what Gersonman and Bear says, though. Is that correct? Gersonman and Bear doesn't reference anything about the court order or the court going outside of its order. It references whether the... it says specifically, the trial court erred in finding that the probation officer had the authority under the Code of Virginia to impose the sex offender special instructions of probation and parole. So it doesn't actually make mention of the order and whether... either the inclusion or failure to include is error. It mentions something completely different in terms of the statutory interpretation.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree. I mean, it's our position that the court didn't order it, and
but
so that...
I'm reading from your son of error. I'm asking in terms of how you framed it for this court to try to get at what specifically before us.
Your Honor, our position, I believe that we had elaborated on that.
Excuse me, could you speak up a little, please?
Yes, Your Honor. It's our position that, number one, the trial court did not impose those terms and that the probation office did not have its own authority to go out and do so. Under the Douglas case that the Commonwealth mentions in that case, which I think is a clearly distinguishable, is that in that case the court said that it was giving to the probation office or is ordering the defendant to comply with all rules and regulations promulgated by the probation office. In this matter here, the court said that Mr. Clark, that the probation office could supervise Mr. Clark. In other words, Your Honors,
the Douglas also said that essentially, if you're using Douglas, which is persuasive but not binding on this court, also indicates that essentially that Rule 1:1 would govern this situation since it's past the 21 days in terms of the majority position. Whether I agree with that or disagree, you were, I thought, relying more on Judge Petty's dissent.
Yes, Your Honors. But the point being to distinguish between, well, there was that as well. I mean, in Douglas, what this court said was that that Douglas could not raise the issue. He was barred from it because it was a collateral attack on a different order. We are attacking this order itself. Yes, Your Honor?
You managed to confuse me a little bit here now. Let me see if I understand. Your argument on brief was essentially, the trial, as I understood it at least, the trial court, by saying you must comply with all the conditions of the sex offender registry, was improperly delegating its authority to set the conditions of probation to the probation and parole office. That's what I understood it to be arguing on brief. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, Judge Malvo has just pointed out that your assignment of error suggests that the what the judge ordered here was inconsistent with the Code of Virginia General. And I'm not sure I necessarily...
I thought we're talking about the special rules of the Department of Corrections.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're saying the trial court didn't impose that, and the probation officer doesn't have the authority to require it.
Not of its own accord, Your Honor. That if the trial court had said that these right. conditions are going to be imposed...
Are you familiar with 53.1-32? If you check that code section. Let me read what it says. The Department of Corrections shall establish and maintain a treatment program for prisoners convicted pursuant to Article 7, which is in parentheses, Sections 18.2-61, et cetera, close parentheses, of Chapter 4, Title 18.2, and committed to its custody. The program shall include a clinical assessment of all such prisoners upon receipt into the custody of the Department of Corrections and the development of appropriate treatment plans if indicated. That's the sex offender treatment program that's created by the Department of Corrections. So now, the Department of Corrections, it seems to be, I should go on to read this, the risk assessment, diagnosis, and treatment refers to sex offenders specifically. It seems to be the department has a program. Now, the probation and parole officers are part of the Department of Corrections. The trial court didn't specifically refer to this particular program, it seems to me, but to say comply with all the regulations or requirements, I should say, of the registry is simply a database. So I guess I'm wondering if this just simply wasn't an inartful way for the trial court, Judge Doyle, I think it was, you know, wanted this particular individual to participate in this particular program. Why is that a reasonable construction of the court's order?
Judge, that specifically refers to an entirely different regime of requirements. I would respectfully disagree with the court that it's just a database. Section 9.1 in the Sex Offender Crimes Against Minors Registry has a number of registration requirements. It has a number of timetables, things that can be restricted by persons who are on the registry, whereas the probation and parole requirements referred to by the court under the 53.1-32, those are a different set of requirements. Additionally, and it was Judge Fulton, I believe, who initially sentenced Mr. Clark to the he gave him the probation. It was Judge Doyle who conducted the revocation hearing, and I would disagree that that was he was saying the same thing. What he was saying in that was that Mr. Clark was required to maintain compliance with the registry and that his probation officer had the authority to supervise that. One way that the court could see those things as being distinguishable is that he's basically saying that because this is a term of his probation, that it's not going to require proof beyond reasonable doubt that he violates any of those terms for that to result in a revocation of his probation, that they could simply, that the Commonwealth could simply show that, you know, by a preponderance of the evidence that he had violated those terms.
You need to keep speaking up because you're dropping off and I'm having more trouble hearing you. But let me ask you, it seems to me the registry is created by statute. The statute says it's maintained by the Department of State Police, and is staffed accordingly, and it also requires both registration upon certain conditions and re-registration on, you know, periodically. That's all the code says with respect to the actual registry, it seems to me. But that's different from the treatment of those who are considered sex offenders who, by the way, also have to register. And so I guess we can all agree, I think, based on this court's precedent, that circuit court judges cannot just routinely delegate to the probation and parole office their responsibility to set terms and conditions of probation. I think we can agree on that.
Yes, Your Honor.
But to some extent, it seems to me, the law also contemplates some discretion on the part of probation and parole for example, they don't necessarily have to violate someone who drops a dirty urine or who fails to report. They have some discretion about whether to do that. So the enforcement of the conditions, you know, of probation and parole are, you know, to some degree are up to the discretion of the probation and parole office. There is this registry, it seems to me. Well, there's the registry, but there's also this treatment program that's provided for in the Department of Corrections. I'm not sure what their internal, I don't think the record is clear about what their internal practices are with respect to that. But certainly, I don't think you can say that the Code of Virginia does not contemplate treatment of individuals who are in the custody of the Department of Corrections who are sex offenders. And so if the circuit court's order imposing this condition of probation can be fairly read to, by way of intent, to include treatment as a sex offender, and there is a program within the Department of Corrections, and the Probation and Parole Office, as a part of the Department of Corrections, can participate or as an administrator of that, why is the circuit court without authority to do what it did?
Your Honor, I disagree that the circuit court did that. That's our whole position, is that the circuit court did not delegate that authority to the Department of Probation and Parole to do that. That it was rather the...
What did the circuit court do? What is your position that the circuit court did do in this case?
The circuit court enabled the Department of Probation and Parole to supervise Mr. Clark with respect to his not being of places where drugs were used, manufactured, sold, etc., and that it supervised him with respect to his general reintegration to society, and it authorized the Department of Probation and Parole to supervise him with respect to his maintenance.
What was the reference to the sex offender registry? What was that all about?
That was all about ensuring that Mr. Clark complied with Section 9.1 and following of the Virginia Sex Offender Registry and Crimes Against Minors Act.
Which is what? What was, is he required to do anything other than register?
No, Your Honor.
Then why is that even necessary? Because in the court's order, because he had to do that anyway, given the nature of his conviction.
Well, the court order also ordered him to be of uniform good behavior, but all persons are presumed to be required to be of uniform good behavior, regardless of whether or not we're probationers or parolees and that sort of thing.
Under DOC rules, probation officer is required to, or the DOC has these sex offender special instructions that each person on probation has to follow. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, let me ask you this. Without the court specifying, can the probation officer impose a curfew?
I believe that, Your Honor, it would be dependent on the circumstances, but I would concede that there are certain circumstances that a probation officer could impose that, yes.
Could the probation officer require that the probationer obtain employment or steady employment?
I would concede that subject to certain requirements, yes, it could do that.
Are you saying they have to be tailored to this specific defendant?
And yes, Your Honor, that was an assignment of error that was not granted by this court. But that
so
is,
you would agree that there are conditions that are properly imposed by the probation officer that aren't contained in the trial court's sentencing order?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Judge, it's simply our position that these particular restrictions go well beyond the ordinary understanding of probation. That when you start requiring somebody to not have internet, to not be around any minor child, that sort of thing, that you're going well beyond.
He was convicted of a sex offense, wasn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not burglary or possession of cocaine.
No, Your Honor.
Aren't all of those special conditions related to a sex offender?
They might be in some cases, but certainly not in all cases. There's no indication that Mr. Clark ever used the computer to as to assault any of his victims or that any of his victims were three-year-old boys, which is the person that he violated the terms of probation for, or that he ever used a car, or that his gambling apps had anything to do with that. In this case, these are extraordinary measures that were imposed by the Department of Probation and Parole. And that's why...
I forgot, 10 points or whatever, are they all extraordinary? Or some of them relevant and some of them aren't?
Your Honor, it's our position that all of those are extraordinary positions that the Department imposed on him.
Given, I guess my... I don't know if you ever answered my earlier question, which is given your client's conviction for 18.2-67.1, which clearly is encompassed by Article 7 of... Title 18.2, which is the Sex Offender Treatment Program of the Department of Corrections, why is it unreasonable for him to comply with the terms and conditions set by that department, given it, which clearly comes within the statutory authority granted to it by 53.1-32, whether the circuit court orders it or not? Why does the probation and parole office have the independent authority to recommend treatment requirements under the authority of the Department of Corrections?
I'm sorry, I'm not quite following the court's question.
The probation parole office is part of the Department of Corrections.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. 53.1-32 says for certain qualifying offenses of which your client was convicted of one, there's a treatment program the Department of Corrections operates.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the department has the discretion to, you know, dictate what the appropriate treatment is for that program.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't it a reasonable interpretation that the probation and parole officer, as an employee of the Department of Corrections, and, you know, dealing with someone in his custody, his or her custody, has the authority to apply whatever regulations and requirements are for that Department of Corrections program to a qualifying individual under their supervision?
Your Honor, I take the position that this wasn't a treatment program that Mr. Clark's probation officer ordered him to.
Well, if he's sexually assaulting children, why isn't it a reasonable part of treatment to say stay away from children?
Against all children is an issue. If you're going to say stay away from certain children that are of the demographics of the victims, that's one thing.
Well, there we're getting into whether or not, you know, the treatment program itself has the authority to be as broad, I guess, as it was, not whether they have the authority in the first place.
Well, Your Honor, that's not what Mr. Clark was required to do wasn't a treatment program. This was a bunch of things that he could not do, not to the sort of remedial program that's designed
to prevent him from reoffending. Isn't that pretty basic to any kind of treatment?
But none of those factors were ever found by the court to be necessary towards the prevention of his reoffending. It's the court that is empowered under the 19.2-304 to determine the terms of probation. The court had the opportunity at that point to determine whether or not, to determine rather what was necessary for the terms of Mr. Clark's probation, and it found certain things. And just because it said on there that we've got, you know, a duck is required doesn't mean that a chicken is required as well. These are distinctive. These things are distinguishable, and a treatment program is distinguishable from an array of prohibitions that Mr. Clark was founded from.
We've queued up your rebuttal time. This is a question, so I'm going to give you 2 minutes of rebuttal anyway. You can make rebuttal over it right now.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sherrill.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. From the Court's discussion just now, it seems as if the briefs and what the Court's...
Ms. Fitzgerald, see if we can narrow the focus of this. Would the Commonwealth concede that the circuit court judge cannot
at least under our current precedent, cannot delegate the setting of special terms and conditions of probation to the probation and parole officers?
No, Your Honor, I don't think I would concede that. However, I don't know that it matters in this case.
Clearly, the code specifically says it's the circuit court judge that imposes terms and conditions of probation, not the probation. They enforce them, they don't set them.
Your Honor, I believe that the code has, in essence, I believe that there are that there's co-authority, that the court can set them and probation and parole can set them. Otherwise, we would read out.
Please point me to the part of the code of Virginia that says probation and parole officers can set the terms and conditions of probation.
So 53.1-10 says that the board of the Department of Corrections and the director of the Department of Corrections sets the rules and regulations that govern the duties and responsibilities of the officers under this article, which includes supervising probation and parolees under 145.
That's the operative word, is supervising, though, isn't it? I mean, it's not. Yeah, I mean, this court has held, in fact, that the circuit court judge cannot just say to a defendant, you know, you follow whatever terms and conditions are set by the probation officer.
Well, I think, Your Honor, you know, what this court has held, for example, in Wilson, is that you can't delegate the setting of amount of restitution. That's a factual finding that involves an adversarial process, and that's not the kind of factual finding that can be delegated to a probation officer. 53.1145 directs the probation officers to follow the rules set by the director of the Department of Corrections, as well as those set out by the court. The court here did impose some conditions, and the Department of Corrections has also imposed guidelines on this person.
What was done here was pursuant to the circuit court's directive, or was it done independently pursuant to whatever authority you think the Department of Corrections gave the probation and parole officer?
Commonwealth's position is that it's done pursuant to a delegation of that authority, because the court in this case, on appendix page 42, interpreting its own prior order, said that authority had been delegated to probation and parole in this case.
Well, the prior order only said comply with the sex offender registry.
Well,
whatever that is. I mean, to me, the registry is just, as I indicated earlier, a database that you have to register for if you meet certain criteria in terms of your conviction.
Sure, Your Honor. And again, we're starting from a starting point of a circuit court interpreting its own order, which is entitled to deference in this court, as long as that interpretation is reasonable. And here what we have is supervised probation, not just regular probation, being ordered as a condition of a suspended sentence. If the defendant was not required to comply with the terms and conditions set by probation, that condition would have no meaning. So here we have a court ordering supervised probation as a condition of a suspended sentence.
Some specificity in terms of what that supervised probation is rather than generically say supervised probation. I think that's the point of the appellant is.
Yes, Your Honor. And if that is the case, and that's what this case comes down to, my position would be that he cannot collaterally attack that delegation in this proceeding.
Well, and I'll circle back to that, but let me ask you a question in reference to how the assignment of errors actually framed. What's the Commonwealth's position in terms of how the assignment of errors framed in terms of whether we're looking at the order or whether we're looking at the probation officer's authority
under the
statutory scheme?
Your Honor, my understanding of the defendant's position was that because there was no delegation, any authority must come from the code. And because under his reading of the code, there is no authority in the code, that's why the court erred.
So your position would be that we're looking really at the statutory scheme and whether the probation officer would have the authority under the department actually impose any rules, that's what the assignment of errors.
Yes, Your Honor, because the defendant in this case assumes that the court did not delegate. And we differ in that respect in how we read the court's order and how the trial court read its own order in this case as to whether that delegation took place. So under the defendant's reading of that order, any authority must come from the code, which is how we get to his assignment of error. Under the Commonwealth's reading of the record and under the trial judge's reading of the record, that authority could have easily also come from the trial court's first order.
Well, the problem for us, the procedural default aside, I think that's a significant issue that Judge Melville has mentioned. We haven't talked about much yet, but that aside for a moment, the problem is, what is a defendant on notice as to what they're supposed to do, you know, in terms of avoiding being violated? And so where a court says, comply with the terms of the registry, If all that means is you register, okay, that's fine. If the court in this case had said comply with the terms of a sex offender treatment program, then I think probably, assuming without deciding that were the case, I don't think any of us would have an issue with the probation parole officer having the discretion to pursue, whatever specific requirements would effectuate a treatment program. So I think they have that level of discretion. But to violate someone for, even though the circuit court interprets its later, its own order later on after the defendant has been violated, the question is what reasonably could a defendant have understood to be the requirements? And if the probation officer was imposing them on his own without authority, should that constitute, grounds for violation? That's, I think, our dilemma here.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I think this goes again back to the timing. This defendant was provided and signed written copies of these instructions, two separate sets.
I think what Judge Humphreys is speaking to is in reference to the court order, not what comes later that the department might issue or mandate.
Yes, Your Honor, and I am trying to answer the court's question in that we're talking about when he has an opportunity, when does he know what's going to be required of him, and he knows what's going to be required of him when he goes to probation. And had he not signed those, he would have been back in front of the court to discuss the propriety of those actions. Had he moved to modify the terms of his probation, he would have been back in front of the court to discuss the propriety of those actions. What he's not at liberty to do is to sign them, say I'll follow them, disregard them, lie about disregarding them, and then come into court and say I was never bound by them anyway.
Well, I think we held in Douglas, and you haven't cited that case, but that was the case, I think, where we reaffirmed that courts couldn't delegate their authority to set conditions of probation. But it was the old void versus voidable argument that if you don't take issue with it in a timely fashion, to argue to the court, hey, you can't do this to me, you don't have the authority to do this, then you're essentially, you're out of luck if you wait too long to raise it.
Mm-hmm.
And, maybe that's the situation we have here, I don't know.
Yes, sir, and I think my previous question, what I understood the court to be asking there was getting to Judge Petty's dissent in that case where he had concern over how the probationer was to know what was going to be required of them at the time the order was entered in time to timely object.
The dissent actually focused more on 19.2303 in reference to whether there was some sort of expansion as it related to Rule 1:1 for these types of orders. But in fact, there was a carve-out for these orders.
Yes, Your Honor.
He would get to the merits,
Yes, Your Honor. And for the same reason that, and I may be putting words in Judge Petty's mouth, but for the same reason that Douglas dissent, said that those matters could have been considered at the revocation proceeding, they could have also been considered at any point prior to that proceeding. And the defendant has the obligation not to just disregard these terms and later say he wasn't bound by them, but to bring the matter to the court's attention first. He got the benefit of his bargain. He was at liberty in the community despite the offenses he was committed of because he promised to follow certain rules. He did not follow those rules, and he's now not at liberty afterwards to come back and say, that those didn't apply to me when he agreed to them in writing, when everyone thought that he was following them. And that's the position the defendant is in here. And so whether that is an approbate, reprobate issue where he has agreed to those rules and is now disagreeing with them, or it's an issue coming before the court with clean hands, it's not a timely challenge to that delegation of authority if what this court perceives the actual challenge to be a delegation of that authority. And I don't think this case presents a good opportunity for the court to delve in again as Judge Humphreys noted, the majority in Douglas said that a carte blanche to probation and parole was an improper delegation. The Commonwealth's position would be that there are limited circumstances, and certainly in this case, given the coextensive statutory authority of the Department of Probation and Parole to impose these terms, as the court noted, to impose those sexual offender treatment programs. And I would note that Condition J of the defendant's special instructions for sex offenders was that he complete one of those programs. That is contemplated by the statute that Judge Humphreys referred to. He failed to do that three times, according to the probation officer. So certainly the probation office did have the authority to require him to complete that Term J specific piece of probation in here. And the trial court, again, going back, if we were to get to the merits of this, found that all of these conditions were actually appropriate, found that they were relevant to the crimes that he was committed of, and found that they were an appropriate use of the probation officer's discretion in this case. So if the defendant's day in court was at this revocation hearing, the court heard him and rejected that argument, and certainly not before the court on appeal that these weren't appropriate, only that the probation officer didn't have the opportunity or didn't have the statutory authority to impose them. And I think I'm running around in circles here, but to get back to your question, Judge Malvo, about the assignment of error, if we are going to limit the defendant to the assignment of error about whether the code allows this kind of imposition, I believe that it does. And we've argued on brief that 53.1, 53.110, 53.1145, and 53.1140, especially combined with the other provision that Judge Humphreys pointed out, I believe it was 32, certainly do give probation and parole the authority to govern, to impose rules and regulations that govern supervised probation. They're supposed to be rehabilitating this defendant, and they're also supposed to be protecting society. These are valid goals. The United States Supreme Court has held that sex offenders are a serious threat, and they are likely to reoffend. And so probation and parole must have some discretion to craft rules that will both protect society from these offenders and also rehabilitate them so that they can rejoin. And to read out that authority from the code, I think would be contrary to principles of statutory construction, because, again, we do have to give, where we can, we have to reconcile these code sections and give full force and meaning to both. So I think the best way of doing that would be to say that the trial court has authority and probation and parole also has authority. There's nothing in either of those code sections that excludes anyone else from exercising that authority. And, in fact, 53.1145 notes the dual obligation to follow rules set by probation and parole, which in this case is sex offender special instructions are on Department of Corrections letterhead, and the probation officer testified that they're given to every sex offender in the state, which, by the way, I think a reasonable inference from that is that the defendant was familiar with these instructions. We have the defendant's criminal history in the sealed portion of the appendix, along with the major violation report. The defendant was certainly convicted of sex offenses. He was on probation before, and he's been convicted of probation violations before. So if the probation officer is correct that every sex offender in the Commonwealth gets these instructions, the defendant knew that these were coming when he was violated for this offense. And of course, the court made no finding to that effect, but I think it's a reasonable inference from the testimony before the court. Happy to answer further questions that the court has.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Barrett, you have 2 minutes. Let me ask, as you're approaching, do you want to respond to the Attorney General's argument about this being invited error in the sense that your client accepted these terms and conditions and didn't take the opportunity to go back to the court and ask them to set aside?
Yes, Your Honor. In the Douglas case, the court noted that Mr. Douglas was explained the special sex offender conditions basically a week after he was convicted. In the case at bar, the sentencing order was from April 2nd of 2015. Sex offender special conditions were not explained to Mr. Clark until December 22nd of 2015. And so there was no meaningful opportunity for him to have come in within the 21-day rule to have addressed that issue. Moreover, I would submit to the court that the probation office is not the appropriate venue to mount objections. It's not the appropriate place to ask for a Big Mac. It's not the appropriate place to ask for an oil change. There are things that probation officers do, and one of those things is not to revise the court's...
I guess the point is he could have declined to sign them and then to take it back before the court to go from there.
I would submit to the court that that's a meaningless choice that the Commonwealth proposes for that. His option at that point is to sign what is presented to him by his probation officer or to go back to jail. Because his choice is either to go back to jail or to sign that piece of paper that he does not have counsel there for to address.
They would file a major violation report, which would then go back to circuit court for a hearing. It doesn't necessarily be incarceration.
That's not what a person in Mr. Clark's position would understand, I would submit to the court, is not that he's given a piece of paper. There's no indication what that his options were explained to him. And as far as he would have known, he would have gone back to jail. As far as the Commonwealth's contention that he should have known about this beforehand, there's no indication that of when the Department of Probation and Parole started issuing these rules and whether or not Mr. Clark would have been familiar with them prior to that day.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.